Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, this is the New Books Network podcast. My name is Joseph Edwards, and today I'm excited to bring you an interview with the writer and violinist Edward Dusenberry. As first violinist of the Tokach Quartet, Ed has won a Grammy as well as awards for the Gramophone magazine, the Japanese Recording Academy, Chamber Music America, and the Royal Philharmonic Society. Combining an international career with his long-standing appointment as the artist-in-residence at the University of Colorado in Boulder, Ed performs as a member of the Tokach in the USA, UK, Europe and Asia, and is an associate artist at London's Wigmore Hall. His first book, Beethoven for a Later Age, The Journey of a String Quartet, melded music, history and memoir to illuminate the circumstances surrounding the composition of Beethoven's quartets, and the Tokach Quartet's experience playing this music. For this work, he won the Royal Philharmonic Society's 2016 Creative Communication Award. They expressed how few have told so well of the musician's life or offered such illuminating insights to players and listeners alike. Ed's latest book, Distant Melodies, Music in Search of Home, was published by Faber and the University of Chicago Press. He writes, "When a melody triggers a vivid memory, it may both offer a connection to the past and illuminate how far one has travelled. This book explores ideas of home, displacement, and return in the lives and chamber music of four composers whose work I began playing early in my musical life. These are Antonín Dvořák, Béla Bartók, and Benjamin Britten." This book is the topic of our discussion today, and Ed, it's really such a pleasure to speak with you.
Very nice to speak with you too.
So you grew up in England, and I believe you're the son of two academics, and your childhood is really a presence throughout the book. And I was wondering if we could begin with getting an understanding of where your desire to write evolved. Have you always written or wished to write? And how this kind of corresponds to your instrumental career?
Yeah, I think the first thing that comes to mind is that as a kid, I read a lot, and particularly on holidays. And I talk about my grandparents and their cottage in Shropshire that we had sort of rather idyllic holidays in growing up. And sometimes the weather wasn't great, and wonderful sort of bookshelves full of complete Thomas Hardy novels, I remember particularly. So I read a lot. I suppose I was very lucky to have good teachers at school for the subjects I was drawn towards, particularly English literature, and I've always enjoyed doing that. I didn't do a tremendous amount of writing at all, except what was required of me. And I think I really became interested in that really after I joined the quartet. I was asked to initially to write an article about a Beethoven cycle we were doing at the South Bank Center. And that piqued my interest. I think one of the things that kept me sane in the early years in the quartet was while I was learning a tremendous amount of music and wondering if I was up to the task, I enjoyed learning about both the lives of the composers that I was playing and also some of the stories of the first players who played this music. And that sort of got me interested, and I wrote a couple of articles along those lines. So that's sort of how I got into it.
Excellent. And you mentioned your idyllic holidays and at your grandparents' house, and it sounds like they were especially important in your musical studies. Do you think you could give us a sense of who they were and I guess the significance they hold within your book?
Yeah, so my grandfather, John Stainer, was actually the grandson of the composer, Sir John Stainer, who wrote Crucifixion and a lot of choral music, and was also very important in music education, very closely tied up with the Royal College of Music. And so my grandfather, John, was a very good pianist and an organist, and ended up first of all, he taught music at the Shrewsbury School, and then he ended up being what was then called the registrar at the Royal College of Music. It was an administrative job that in this country, I think we would describe as being a dean. He had to do a lot with sort of faculty and student relations, and I still run into people in the profession who were former students at the Royal College and sort of very grateful for his guidance and his sort of beneficence and generosity. I was lucky enough to hear him playing the piano a lot. By the time that we went to Shropshire, he and Gran were retired, and every day there was music in the house. So that's really how I got to hear Beethoven and Schubert piano sonatas, for example. My Gran was an oboist, and she taught oboe privately and Eton for many years. And the timing was just very lucky for me as a grandchild that the time I spent with them, they were retired, they were relaxed, there was a lot of music in the house, and it was a beautiful environment.
Sure. And so you studied with Howard Davis, who is the violinist in the Alberni Quartet, and you also attended things like the National Youth Orchestra. I was just wondering if you could paint a quick picture of your musical education in the UK before you moved to the US.
Yeah, so I was very lucky to find Howard as a teacher from, I think, about the age of 14. He and the Alberni Quartet had a residence in Harlow, and my dad used to drive me down the M11 from Cambridge, and I had my lessons there. He was such a force of nature, Howard. Worked incredibly hard, tremendous enthusiast, both for the repertoire, for the music, and for his students, and just incredibly motivating for me. From there, and also my first introduction to quartets. From there, I went to the Royal College, did my undergraduate degree there with Felix Andreevsky, wonderful Ukrainian violinist and teacher, and again, a very inspiring. He was so inspiring that after I stopped studying with him, I kind of almost found it a bit difficult to perform because I sort of wished he was on stage with me to make all the great facial expressions, and sort of the way he communicated character was such a strong thing. So that was the sort of basis of my UK education. It was really formative for me being in the National Youth Orchestra between the ages of about 11 and 17, I guess. That's where I sort of first got the idea of what it might be like to be a touring musician, although quite a glamorous version of it, really. Everything was laid on for us and we played wonderful venues. I remember doing a Mahler Sixth with Simon Rattle and Tarangalila Symphony with Mark Elder. Very, very formative, wonderful experiences.
Oh, I bet. I also did Tarangalila at NYO, and it
did you?
Was such a huge piece to play. Just blew my mind when I did it. So you studied with Andreevsky, and then you moved to another great pedagogue in New York, Dorothy DeLay. For those who don't know, Dorothy DeLay was a great 20th century violin pedagogue who had an untold influence in the US in violin and broadly, more broadly, possibly chamber music. She was a mentor to Isaac Perlman and Sarah Chang and Nigel Kennedy. And I just really love to get some insight into your time with her. What was she like as a teacher? You have quite a funny first meeting with her that you depict in the book.
Yeah, I think Dorothy DeLay, I learned later, felt that she had a special mission with her English students, students from the UK. She was under the impression that we were all a little bit mollycoddled, and that we were all perhaps encouraged, given a little bit too much encouragement. So she saw it as her role to cut us down to size. And I don't think that my first meeting with her was a deliberate attempt to do that. But, I traveled over to New York a couple of weeks before, gone through all the orientation activities. I was pretty well primed for my first lesson playing Tchaikovsky Concerto. I showed up and she looked at me and she said, Nicholas Milton from Australia? and this kind of set the tone a little bit for the first few months with her. It definitely was an ego bruising experience. She true to her name, she was often very late with her lessons. So one could, my lesson was 7 o'clock in the evening, but I rarely actually got in the room until 10:30 at night. So one spent a lot of time waiting. And I even wrote a little mini play, I think, called Waiting for Delay, having studied Waiting for Godot at A level. But when you were in the room with her, she was incredibly perceptive about playing. And I think one of the things that she wanted to work with me on, she sort of noticed that sometimes I would play in a kind of inspired, characteristic way, deep, very involved in what I was doing. But she was curious what my backup plan was on those days when I didn't feel particularly inspired, or was, you know, just didn't feel good, and or was playing in a bad acoustic. Her studio was one of the worst acoustics you can imagine. So she really wanted to work on foundational stuff, on basics, kind of take me back to some basics. Give you an example. She said in an early lesson, just kind of a little bit humiliating for a 20-year-old or however old I was, honey, we need to teach you to use your ears, which, you know, it's a little rough. But what she meant by that is somehow when you're caught up in the emotion of playing, it's you can quite easily stop really listening to what you're doing. Another aspect of the ego bruising was to be surrounded by players who were in many ways much more advanced than I was on a regular basis. But one of the great educational things were the studio classes with 4 or 5 violinists. This happened once a week. And we all got a chance to listen to each other. I didn't love playing in those classes, but I did love the conversations, the feedback. It was very inspiring to me. And gradually, you know, when after 6 months, she kind of realized that I was going to be there for the long term. I wasn't discouraged. I wanted to learn. And then she said, she actually told me, well, you know, I kind of tend to test my UK violinist to see what they're made of. And once I got over that initial hurdle, we had a very wonderful experience. And of course, I was incredibly grateful to her, because the only reason I had the audition for the Tokash Quartet was because she recommended me.
Sure. Well, I'm glad from that we've kind of established what your first writing project was, which was a parody of Dorothy Delay. But it sounds like an unsettling and destabilizing moment at times. And you write, and I feel like this is quite pertinent to the book. So you write about the idea of longing, and the kind of also the version of Englishness that you encountered when you got to the US. So not only was Delay approaching you with a certain sense of Englishness, but you were also speaking of orchestral projects with Vaughan, playing Vaughan Williams and Elgar. Could you speak a bit about that and what the kind of attitude was at the Juilliard at the time and in the US more broadly to these composers, and how that affected your own sense of yourself?
Yeah, it was a shock to me, because I grew up, you know, with Elgar, String Serenade, just loving playing that actually in family type of environment. I think I was naive about Land of Hope and Glory. It was a glorious tune, glorious melody. It was the first prom I went to. I was a school's prom, and I couldn't believe how beautiful it was. I wasn't thinking about the words. I wasn't thinking about the associations of English Empire. And I was shocked when we played Elgar's First Symphony during my first semester at Juilliard by the degree of sort of satire, borderline derision from some of my Juilliard classmates about this sort of perception of Elgar and England being something sort of very old-fashioned and out of date and something worthy of ridicule. And that was, I have to say, that didn't help my homesickness. And completely consistent. We ended up doing a very good performance of Elgar's First Symphony, but it was really food for thought. And I think, of course, that's one of the really valuable things about leaving your home country, is to to start to view it from different and other people's perspectives. And it was a painful time for me in that sense. And I think coming back to writing the book was to some extent exploring how my relationship to England has necessarily changed over the 30 years or so that I've lived abroad. I still miss aspects of the country and people very much, but my view of the country, of course, has changed, and the country has changed an enormous amount in the last 30 years.
Of course. And this book is also framed around the COVID-19 pandemic. And I feel like that links quite well, because COVID obviously shut down the possibility of going back. And I think for a lot of people who weren't living in their place of birth or had family elsewhere, it was suddenly that idea of being abroad gained a whole different perspective, because you were quite literally not able to go back home, not go back to whatever your sense of home was, not go back to your family, I guess. Did that have a big impact? Was that a psychological change?
Yes, I mean, COVID was really when I pulled these different ideas and different composers together and wrote seriously, because I had time. And music is a way you can travel when you can't travel in other ways. And so, for example, we were working on Benjamin Britten's third string quartet, and that was, I think, a piece that we played. We live streamed it for an empty hall here at our series at the University of Colorado. That was the first experience of playing in an empty hall. And of course, that piece he wrote at the end of his life. He wrote it in Aldeburgh. Having grown up in Cambridge, I spent some time in Aldeburgh, so playing the piece took me there. The piece is very evocative of Venice and his opera Death in Venice. So that's a great piece for traveling. And I had time to think a lot about Benjamin Britten's time in America at the beginning of the Second World War, and sort of 1939 to 1942-ish. And, he wrote his first string quartet while he was in California, which when I first played the piece, I'm embarrassed to say I hadn't known. COVID really, as you said, it sort of focused one's mind on those themes of music and how music can help to reconnect you to places that you may feel that you've lost, and also to some extent can be painful, because they can conjure up memories of people and places that you realize you're very far away from.
Absolutely. So it sounds like that this project was conceived in COVID, in the midst of that. And it's a really interesting book in the way it straddles both memoir and also sometimes quite traditional biography. Your section on Dvorak in America feels in many ways like a kind of classic bit of musicology. And at other times you are very much going back into your childhood and making interesting links between Elgar and Britten and your own life. And it's a stylistic feat that you do really effectively. And I was just wondering how difficult it was as a process to kind of work out how to structure this book, and how much thought went into that, because it feels like a difficult thing to do.
Yeah, I think that's the challenge and that's the interest for me. And I think it's quite hard to gauge how much memoir, as you said, and how much of the composers' lives. But I've always been just very interested by composers' lives. And for example, working on Dvorak, I think I hadn't realized how unhappy he was when he was in America, particularly in New York. And somehow discovering that changed the way I thought about some of his music that I'd always kind of associated him with beginnings and lively freshness and kind of relaxation and something a bit lighter to play after late Beethoven. And I started to rethink that and see a much darker dimension to some of his music. I think really in terms of the structure, it's very much trial and error in the writing. And I remember particularly working on the chapter about Benjamin Britten, which is really set during the pandemic, with me stuck in Boulder. That was particularly hard to balance, because I think I started off with too many kind of anecdotes about things that happened during COVID and the difficulties of living at home and not being able to go anywhere. And, you know, that's of moderate interest. And I probably in the end used those as sort of more linking passages to more stuff about the music and in the end, more stuff about Britten's life. I mean, I'm not a celebrity, yes. So, I mean, really the point of the memoir stuff is, of course, I want to be somewhat revealing about the process of being in a string quartet. This we'll get to this, but this book covers a lot of change within the Tokash Quartet and how the idea of home within the Tokash Quartet, sense of identity, has changed. So I wanted there to be that element. But I suppose one of my goals as a writer is to encourage people to, you know, if they read the book and then they go out and really want to listen to the pieces of music that I've talked about, then job done.
Absolutely. So yeah, to move back to your group, the Tokach, you were obviously the first non-Hungarian to join the group. And I feel like that's a good place to start, just to base this in how you found that. You had this trip to the States and you had this experience of delay. And then I'm guessing it was fairly soon after that you ended up playing with the Tokach. And I was wondering what was the cultural and musical, what were the challenges that came culturally and musically, and also in terms of how audiences reacted?
Yeah, I think the biggest challenge was maybe the same for anyone joining a quartet, which is that the microscope is on you. You're expected to have a strong individual voice, especially my predecessor, Gábor Tokács, who is a wonderful musician and now a very successful conductor. Very charismatic player, played with tremendous musical conviction. These are, you know, hard shoes to fill. So on the one hand, you have to show that you have your own individual voice. At the same time, you're trying to work out how to fit in with a group and the three wonderful Hungarians and the identity that they had evolved in the 18 years since they formed that quartet. And, you know, that's a very hard juggling act to both sort of try and become one of a group and also to express your own voice within that. And frankly, it takes time. And I was very lucky. There were many people who were very supportive of me when I joined. But whenever I see groups make a change and I hear judgments about, oh, it doesn't sound as good as it used to, I'm like, just give them a few years and then you'll know. You just can't know in the first year. I was up against that additional thing of national stereotypes, and maybe to some extent I was confirming them, because the Hungarians played with such freedom and dynamism, and I was a little, to put it bluntly, a little tight and a little stiff and reserved at times. And part of that was partly physical. I had never really spent that much time playing sitting down. And that's as you know, as a violinist, that's something very different. When you stand up, you have the use of your legs and you can move around more easily. And I had to work that out. I went through a stage of sort of moving around ridiculously much. I sort of grew my hair very long to try and sort of look a bit sort of, you know, wilder and more Hungarian. I mean, that didn't work at all. You know, you try different things, but what really helped me immensely was how incredibly supportive Gábor Ormai and Kocsi and András were. They were signed up, and they whatever issue I was having, they never made me feel separate. They said, you know, as long as the four of us are doing well and we're rehearsing, we're enjoying the work, it's all going to be fine. And I'm not sure that they necessarily always felt that, you know, if we got a bad review or something, but they couldn't have been nicer. And I think subsequently I've heard many stories of people joining quartets, and I think it makes me realize how unusual that is, because actually sometimes when a new player joins a quartet, it's very hard for them because the players who are already in the group aren't sufficiently open-minded or encouraging. So I was really lucky. And this business of the national stereotypes kind of, it calmed down after a while. And in one respect, for a very sad reason, which was that Gabor Mai was, the violist, was diagnosed with cancer only a year after I joined and died within 6 months. So it was a tremendously traumatic and upsetting time for the group, and especially for my colleagues. And then, you know, we were very fortunate then that the English violist Roger Tapping joined us. And then that changed the whole dynamic, because then we were two Brits and two Hungarians. We were known as the Anglo-Magyar foursome, was how Time Out described us. And there's, you know, then we got a lot of silly questions about what's it like for two Brits and two Hungarians. But, you know, it was a story. And then also that took the heat off me a little bit, because I was no longer the new kid. I had to actually assume more authority and leadership just because of the kind of crisis situation we were in. So for very sad reasons, actually, that I probably integrated into the group faster because of that very sad change. But yeah, I think we, during that period, we certainly kept a bit quiet about our Englishness and really pushed the continued Hungarian identity of the group. So our recordings that we made of the Bartok quartets for Decca in, I think, 1996, roughly, won a Gramophone Award. And that was very much sort of re-establishing the Tokash Quartet with different personnel, but still very much in that kind of tradition of the music and the repertoire that had made them famous in the first place.
And there's a real musical connection in the UK between Hungarian and British artists. You've got the Sándor Vague Quartet and the Keller Quartet with Andrus Keller, and also Yehudi Menuhin's connection with Béla Bartók. We'll go into the subsequent changes that happened, but I was wondering, you know, the quartets moved from Budapest to Boulder, and I was wondering how you think of the Hungarian roots within your group. So, I suppose, do you still feel not only the impact of the people, the three other musicians that founded the group, but also, you know, the legacy of the Franz Liszt Academy with people like Gudai and Rados and Kurtág? I was wondering if that legacy still influences your sound or your approach. Do you now consider yourselves an American quartet, or what?
I mean, I think we now would consider ourselves as a truly international quartet with a Japanese Jewish second violinist and a Korean American violist, and myself. I'm actually half American. My dad's American, and Andras is our remaining founding member. I think, of course, let me say this again, it's very complicated, this issue of national schools, and I think it's become a lot more fluid because of ease of travel. And I think that when we discuss in the group our influences and our mentors and our teachers, we find common threads that aren't necessarily to do with nationality, they're to do with particular approach to playing. I think in the group we spend a tremendous amount of time talking about character and mood and what we wish to convey. And in terms of the actual sound, you know, as a string player, you know, it's always a trade-off a little bit between projection of sound and sort of making sort of a contact point very near the bridge where you can really have the highest overtones and the sounds really popping out and tremendous clarity and articulation and all these good things. But then if you move a little bit further away from the bridge and a little bit closer towards the fingerboard, you have a, a wide range of colors and sounds that are more mellow and darker and have more of a cushion to them. And I suppose historically the group probably has been a little more in that direction of, we're not the loudest quartet that's out there. When we play piano quintets, we have to ramp it up a little bit compared with what we're usually used to. And we've always really enjoyed exploring, you know, when we're in a very good hall like the Wigmore Hall. I mean, the invitation to explore that quiet range of dynamics, to be able to play incredibly quietly. And so I can't really say that's particularly a national school. You know, I think that's something that maybe drew us all together and is why the four of us have ended up playing together. But the reality is that, you know, nowadays you need to be extremely versatile. We play sometimes in very large halls with bad acoustics. And in that case, you need to be closer to the bridge. And you recognize that in this particular event, you're trying to put out a good sound for the evening, and you won't have that range of very quiet playing. But many of the places we play are ideally suited to chain music. So yeah, it's a mixture of sounds of this talk about character. I think another thing that unites us is that we have quite similar senses of humor. and somehow the group has always laughed a lot. I think when you spend so much time with three other people, it's difficult if there's not really room for people to take themselves too seriously. I mean, it's a fine line. Yeah, you should be confident, obviously, and feel good on stage. But we tease each other and we laugh. And I feel very fortunate. There's not a lot of sort of, you know, kind of strutting around or pretension in the group. We just don't really have time for that. It's not what our music making is about. And again, I think that it's not so much to do with the national school. I think probably the changes in the group have all made us more flexible over the years.
Great. But every time the group shifts, the group changes, you have this really complicated, difficult period where you're both mourning their loss and also auditioning someone new and potentially auditioning multiple people. I was wondering if you could talk about this process of auditioning, like when you find that it's the correct moment to make a decision. And I know that you've experimented with audience participation in the process, and you've sort of veered away from that now. And then through that, kind of bring us up to date with where the group's personnel are at.
Yeah, so... You're right. We've had different processes. Of course, I mentioned the change when Gabor Ormai, you know, that was such a traumatic and sad time, and that change was sort of forced on us very suddenly. More typically, you know, quartets are a very demanding way of life, and Roger Tapping, for example, did a wonderful 10 years. We did Bartoks, we did all the Beethovens together, and then for a variety of reasons, that was the right time for him to leave. And yeah, we had, in that case, we had sort of three finalists that we played concerts with, and they were public concerts. And so, of course, got feedback from the audiences. But since then, yeah, the changes have been, I guess, more discreet. in the end, no one can really know what goes on between four people. It's like a marriage, and sometimes the sort of things that you're gauging have to do with the time that you spend together eating food and, you know, just hanging out. It's not just a matter of the playing. And the most recent change was when Richard joined us, and that was just before the pandemic. And we did play with several people kind of privately, very, very good players. And Jerry Walther had always, you know, she joined the quartet at the age of 55, and she was very consistent. She said she'd do 15 years, and she did 15 magnificent years in the group. And so then I think the only thing that was difficult was her retirement was a little bit faster because of the pandemic. We planned a couple of months of really nice projects with her that sort of featured the viola more, and then the pandemic came along. And so that felt too abrupt. And I think you're absolutely right. It's a difficult balance because you really want to celebrate the work of the person who's retiring, and at the same time, you know, it's not like you can take a year off. You have to play a new player right away, and you have to kind of present that story of the new player. And I think I found it a bit jarring the way we ended up doing that. And I, you know, ideally we would have had a little more time with those last concerts with Jerry and parties and things. And as it was, it was jarring. Then it was jarring in a different way because then we ended up having a lot of time with Richard without any concerts. So it was a very bizarre period, and we were in a kind of COVID bubble together. But it had some benefit because we really incubated as a group. And I think one of the things that's hard for a quartet when a new person joins is that however good the playing is and however much the styles are working and it sounds good, one of the things about a quartet that's unique is the sense of shared life experience. And somehow it's a little bit intangible how that seeps into the playing and the interpretations. But there's no doubt that a group of four people that have gone through a lot of things together provides a kind of a, as long as it's working, it provides a kind of a glue in the playing and the interpretation. You can't just fast track that. I think to some extent we did fast track it with Richard because of the unusual circumstances of COVID. You know, we spent a lot more time together and we were dealing with very specific challenges about, you know, we suddenly had to work out how to make video content together that could be sold and presented to our audiences. So in a weird sort of way, that transition with Richard, by the time we got on the road to play concerts, we already felt pretty well seasoned in our new group.
Sure. Yeah. And
sorry, that was a very long answer. Sorry.
No, not at all. I think you've brought us right up to the to sort of the bit in your book where you talk about how COVID was also difficult to move on from, and in this bubble that you were creating and rehearsing in, and recording in, you released lots of recordings through this time. There's also an element where you don't quite know who you are as a new quartet until you're actually on stage in front of an audience. And I personally know a lot of friends who never struggled with stage fright or things like that in the past, who really wondered whether they were going to be able to go in front of an audience again and how that would feel different and how they'd respond. And I think people had a lot of varied reactions. So did you find that? Did you find that sort of anticipation at going out in front of an audience again almost a little scary?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was definitely an apprehension, perhaps a little bit more sense of doubt. But also, once we were playing for live audiences again, just so much gratitude for the fact that the audience was in the hall. And, you know, somehow, sometimes performers can be a little intolerant of audience noise, of coughs and sneezes and, you know, this kind of thing. But like, I was so glad to hear it, you know, for a while. It's like, I remember backstage at our venue at the University of Colorado and just being back, the backstage area is not a green room. It's like right behind the shell. And that first time that we heard an audience talking, conversing in the hall was pretty magical. So as I look back on it, that transition wasn't too difficult. It was more difficult in my mind and ahead of time. And I think that's often how nerves affect me, actually. I often get nervous in anticipation of things. And then when I'm actually on stage doing it, I love the adrenaline and the sense of just feeling alive.
Well, that's the right way around.
Yeah, exactly.
and throughout the book, you have, you know, you wield a slightly self-effacing, humorous style where you freely acknowledge, you know, mistakes you make and conversations and habits you have with your fellow quartet members. I was wondering how writing two books about the quartet also is a sort of extra dynamic within the group, and how did you send manuscripts to your fellow members, or did you talk about what you, I imagine you have to create some kind of distance, but you're also elucidating a very private and personal space for four people and their professional and personal lives. So I was wondering how you approach that and approach writing the books with them.
Yeah, it's a really good question. And in a way, what you're saying is, what do you say and what do you leave out? So to deal with the practical side of it, in this book, there are several rehearsal scenes. There's an audition scene with Richard. All of anything that had dialogue with my colleagues, colleagues is such a cold word for one's string quartet friends and partners. But whenever there was any dialogue, they read all of that. I don't remember them having anything very substantive to correct or say. I was particularly concerned, Ondrasch features very much in the Toronto, and he spoke very revealingly, I thought, about his some of the feelings he had about going back to Budapest and about Hungary and Hungary as a country. And I, in a way, I was a little bit embarrassed that it took me to write a book and to interview him to find out these things about someone that I've been working very closely with for, by then sort of 3 decades. And yet I learned quite a lot about him through the process of asking him. And of course, I wanted to make sure that he was comfortable with the way he was presented in that. I think it has to be said, and this is true of any memoir, even memoirs that appear to be very revealing, they're only told from one point of view often. And it's important to qualify that, in a quartet especially, this is ongoing work, and there has to be a respect for privacy. And that's I found that quite hard to deal with in a couple of particular cases. But in the end, the most important thing is that the relationships with the string quartet partners and how they go forward. And if that occasionally makes for a slightly less revealing storyline, so be it. That's the price one pays. I really tried to get at the process of how we rehearse and our preoccupations. And I tried to give some examples of how Harumi, when she joined the group, and Richard, how they might have changed the emphasis of how we practiced or how they played a particular phrase. And what is genuine, totally genuine, is that we don't really have arguments in the group. We might have disagreements about the music and things that we try in different ways, but I feel very, very fortunate in this iteration of the group that we get on well, and the work is really about the music. And I think in a string quartet, that's not always the case.
No, that's a rare and special thing to hold on
Yeah,
to.
exactly.
But obviously, each time someone comes in, they're as you've both spoken of, they bring their own experience, and the quartet changes, the sound changes, and your approach changes. And you also talk about your work with other musicians, and notably the Hungarian folk group Muzsikás, and how this affected the way you played Bartók. You did a series of concerts with them, where you interwo you sort of mixed it up with Hungarian folk music. I was wondering if you could talk about firstly that project, that process, but also I think there's a sort of beautiful poetry about a quartet, a group that's been going for so long, but that kind of layers these experiences over each other. And each new person, you might play a piano quintet, and the pianist you work with sort of adds another dimension. And you speak of how you feel differently as a group once that person leaves. And this kind of layering of experience is such a interesting and also essential part of quartet playing, in keeping you fresh as a group and keeping your ideas fresh. So yeah, if you could just give us an introduction to Musicache and this project.
So Musicache is a wonderful ensemble based in Budapest of Hungarians who have, I think actually several of them have other careers. One's a mathematician, one's in physics. They have studied authentic folk music, village music. One of their goals is to play the music that, for example, Bartok or Kodály were inspired by when they themselves were traveling around collecting folk music and recording musicians. It was the idea of the founding second violinist, Kári Schranz, in combination with a New York-based program consultant creator called Joseph Horowitz. And they suggested a joint project that would be a kind of a conversation between the two groups, between us and Musicache. So they also are a quartet of sorts, two violins, a viola, and a bass player, but also with a wonderful singer. And so the evening was like a discussion, a conversation, and we were all on stage for the whole concert. We would hear some of the tunes that they were playing, the settings of things, and then we would play. And so, for example, we played Bartok's fourth quartet, and they jumped up between some of the movements to show the traditional instruments. For example, their violist played a bass recorder, kind of a bass recorder. And so before a particular movement, he would play a kind of a thing on this bass recorder, which gave one a different idea of the kind of texture and color of sound that Bartok might have had in mind when he was writing the next movement. Now, obviously, for purists would not be too thrilled about the arc of Bartok's fourth quartet. That's a sort of five movement arc that would be broken up by hearing these bits of music. And we occasionally someone would complain about that. But on the whole, people loved having this new way of thinking about Bartok. It's not a new way, but for some people, they'd found Bartok's music rather abstract. And to see and hear these folk instruments was a revelation. For us, I think for me in particular, it really helped free me up on stage. I mean, I always found Bartok quite intimidating. And these guys just played with such joy and ebullience and, just a lack of inhibition. And so I really tried to inhabit that spirit more when we were playing with them. So it was a very fulfilling, joyful project for us. And I was listening to your very perceptive comments about how these additional projects kind of keep the group fresh, and we have to be nimble, and whether we're adding another player. Another way that's probably become more significant for us in the newish formation, it's not that new anymore, but the group as we currently are, we've been doing more commissioning of works. And so, for example, this year we're playing a piece by Nokatula Enwenyama, wrote a piece for us, which is sort of inspired by the natural world. It's called Flow. We've surrounded that with a Haydn Sunrise Quartet and Beethoven 59-2 that is also to some extent inspired by the Starry Skies at Night, the slow movement. I think it's wonderful to play contemporary music, to feel that fragility and excitement of a piece being born, and to recognize that with the pieces that we play by Beethoven and Haydn, whoever it is, that spirit of being born and the excitement, the uncertainty, the fragility is a very, very important part of playing. A piece should never sound like it's mainstream in a way. It should always sound like it's radical. And if you can't create that spirit on stage, then maybe choose another piece.
Absolutely. So do you have a tour coming up? Is there a set of concerts that you're looking forward to?
Yeah, well, we've got a few different things. We've also been collaborating with a wonderful bandoneon player called Julien Labro this over the last two or three seasons, and so we have a few concerts with him those playing pieces that were written specifically for us and him by the Brazilian-American composer Clarice Saad, for example. Julian wrote a piece himself. So that's a fun project. And then in May, we come to the UK as part of our associate artist's position at the Wigmore Hall, and we'll be playing quintets with the wonderful French-Canadian pianist Marc-André Hamelin. And we'll be playing the very well-known Dvorak quintet, but coupled with the wonderful quintet by Florence Price. We'll be performing those and then retreating to our favorite recording location in the Wye Valley to record them for Hyperion.
Oh, perfect. And do you have any writing projects in the line?
You know, it's not really. I mean, at the moment, the quartet is so busy and so fulfilling that I'm just happy doing that. And I think anytime you write a book, you realize what an incredible effort is. I have my younger brother is teaches global history and has just written a wonderful book. His name's Martin Duesenberry, and he's kind enough to share some of his writing projects with me in their early stages. And I have various other friends who are writers, so I very much enjoy getting early drafts of their work and being allowed to offer my dubious opinions on them. I think I always feel there could be an opportunity to do more writing-wise with the way that a string quartet works, and I may find a way to do that in the future. But so far, I don't have a burning project.
Absolutely. Well, it was a fantastic read. Distant Melodies, Music and a Search of Home. A reminder, it's published in Faber and University of Chicago Press. And is there an upcoming paperback release?
I don't think there is at the moment. But the hardback is very reasonably priced.
It is. All right. Well, it's been such a pleasure to speak. And I look forward to hopefully attending your Wigmore Hall concert. Your trip to London.
Thanks so much. Enjoyed the conversation so much.